Continuing our reading of Cybernetics and the Origin of Information, we're picking up from the beginning of chapter 2, so that's page 47 of the translation. Like a quick recap of chapter 1, it's all about these different types of what he calls information machines. He's talking about what we now know as digital computers. They already existed at the time he was writing. At that time, they were not sort of the exclusive form of information machine in the way that they maybe are today. There were analog computers and a variety of different types of devices, and cybernetics as like a discipline that was sort of emerging at the time he's writing had also come up with its own sort of prototypes of different kinds of information machines that he talks about, and looks at like trying to, I guess, demythologize them in a way that like the cyberneticians kind of took these prototypes or these like sort of examples of information machines that exhibit this, you know, interesting and seemingly sophisticated behavior. And then they would sort of concluded from that, you know, human, you know, understanding, grasp of significance and so on is really just like a bit more complicated, a bit more sophisticated version of, you know, what's going on in these sort of quite simple information machines. So he talks about, for example, this artificial tortoise that is like a little, you know, wheeled vehicle that sort of moves around and orients toward a light source, but only if that light source is not too bright. If the light is too bright, then it orients away from it. And then the environment for this artificial tortoise is set up in such a way that the light sources are sort of signposts for charging stations for the battery of the artificial tortoise. And then this feedback mechanism that, you know, governs the orientation towards or away from the light source is also tied to the level of charge in the battery. So as the battery becomes depleted, the aversion, if you sort of use that anthropomorphic term for this behavior, so that this like aversion towards light or aversion away from light, is sort of overcome by the sort of hunger, if you, again, using this sort of anthropomorphization. So as the battery is depleted, the tortoise is more likely to go toward the light source that it would avoid if its battery were at a higher level of charge. And then the sort of last component of this artificial tortoise is a kind of tactile sensor at the front, which disengages the light orientation mechanism. And what the result of that is that if the device runs into an obstacle and you know the front of the device hits this obstacle, then instead of just, you know, keeping, you know, pushing forward in the same direction with no movement because it has an obstacle in front of it, it's just sort of randomly swings from one side to the other until it happens to get around the obstacle. And then at that point, the tactile sensor disengages and the light orienting mechanism re-engages and it, you know, resumes its path towards the light or away from the light, depending on the intensity. And you know, all these different mechanisms together produce a device that kind of simulates like a simple organism, you know, that has like a few different, you know, priorities or like drives, I guess you could say, and you know, in light seeking and avoiding, and then, you know, getting around an obstacle. So I compared it to like a worm last time, that like it might be sort of tracking a gradient of a certain chemical that it like, you know, that sort of leads in the direction of food. But it might at the same time try to avoid a certain, say, like exposure to predation, you know, certain types of environments are increase the risk of predation. And then it also might, you know, if it runs into an obstacle while following this gradient, it, you know, is probably not capable of like planning a detour, but it is capable of just sort of exploring until it finds a path that allows it to pick up that gradient again and, you know, keep following the gradient. So yeah, this kind of you know, simple behavior that results from this like interaction of a few different drives or priorities is sort of simulatable in this fairly simple device, which just includes like basically three different feedback mechanisms that are like connected in this way. And then the next type of device, which is a bit more sophisticated, is the homeostat that he describes. And this is a kind of like abstract description of a device that you could like implement in various ways, but like the idea is you have like the one that he describes has like four oscillators that are each, you know, they each have their own frequency of oscillation, and you can link them up in such a way that they come to be synchronized. And the with the way that the device is set up, if you sort of perturb one of the oscillators, like you, for example, switch its orientation, like it starts like the feedback, for example, that feeds into this oscillator is reversed, so that now it's like instead of dampening the oscillator, it amplifies the oscillator. The switch in orientation leads to a kind of adjustment of the other oscillators to bring the whole thing back into equilibrium, so that they're all synchronized again. What the sort of cybernetician interpretation of this is that this is a kind of like the kind of simulation of the kinds of like decision making or problem solving performances that humans exhibit. So it's as if you have this system that has a task assigned to it or a problem that it's trying to solve. It's trying to maintain equilibrium, and it's capable of improvising to these like unforeseen interventions where you switch one of the oscillators around to sort of achieve that goal of realizing equilibrium. Of course, this is like a sort of again an anthropomorphization. This is just a simple sort of electronic device made up of a few different circuits connected in a certain way. It doesn't have intentions, but the idea is that this simple electronic device sort of exhibits what the sort of basic principles behind human beings that do have intentions, that our goal-directed behavior is essentially like a more sophisticated version of this sort of simple inter-adjustment of the oscillators to each other. So what Rie wants to do in that, or what he has set out to do in that last chapter that we just finished last week, is to look at all these different types of machines and point to like kind of the gap between what the machine actually does and what the cyberneticians wanted to do or want to draw from the fact that this machine exists. So the cyberneticians want to take the existence of these machines and the fact that you can set up these machines that sort of simulate a fairly sophisticated kind of behavior to demonstrate that the more sophisticated versions that humans exhibit are just like sort of quantitatively more complicated or more sophisticated versions of this simple behavior exhibited in the machines. And Rie sort of insists on this qualitative distinction or ontological distinction and saying that this is actually a distinction in kind, that it's not just a matter of like making the machine a bit more complicated, a bit more clever, et cetera, to sort of capture what it is to grasp the meaning of a sentence or to understand a melody, et cetera, that like there's a sort of fundamental difference between what it is that a human is doing when they understand a sentence and what the machine is doing when it sort of predicts what the next word is going to be, for example. And so that's like sort of the core of this book, is just insisting on that gap between the two, this sort of mechanical, process of simulating even fairly clever behavior that humans are capable of, and then the process of the human actually performing that behavior. Like, these are two fundamentally different things. And so this next chapter is going to be like about this, what one of the sort of basic characteristics of this difference is this difference between what he calls framing activities and framed mechanisms. And so we'll see more about what that means over the course of this chapter. But basically the idea is that these machines, the artificial tortoise or whatever, these are sort of set up with certain parameters, certain like rules of operation, et cetera. These are sort of built with these sort of fixed properties at the outset by a human being, that has consciousness, for example. They're sort of set up to operate within certain environments, certain circumstances, and to follow certain patterns of behavior. And then if they sort of encounter something that doesn't fit within those parameters or certain or those circumstances, then they are no longer capable of anything resembling the sort of quasi-intelligent behavior that they exhibited before. Like in the case of the artificial tortoise, if you restructure their environment so that the light sources don't line up with the charging stations, then they're not capable of finding the charging stations in any other way. They just sort of follow the light source and then their battery depletes and then they die, essentially. Whereas an animal that, you know, might sort of rely on a certain cue for like finding food, to varying degrees of sophistication and are capable of learning that that cue is no longer valid, they should instead follow a different cue, learn some other pattern that leads to the food source. It depends on the type of animal. Like a worm is not going to be able to learn the same kinds of things as a dog, for example. They exhibit this sort of open-ended capacity for learning and adapting their behavior in light of a value or like something, this sort of principle of, you know, maintaining their existence and reproducing themselves. And they will sort of change their behavior and way of approaching the world to realize those goals in a way that these machines are not capable of. And this is even more the case with humans, of course, where we can not only sort of continue our existence and reproduce ourselves, but we can sort of evaluate whether those are goals that we want to pursue at all. We could decide, you know, I don't want to reproduce myself, or I don't want to continue in existence. So we can not just evaluate, like, are these means, a good way of achieving these ends that are sort of set for ourselves, but we can also evaluate those ends and decide that we don't want to pursue those ends anymore. Activity of, you know, framing, like we can set up some kind of process that will pursue a goal. We can build a device, for example, that will achieve a certain goal that we want to achieve. But we can also sort of step back and say, like, is this actually a goal that I want to achieve? Is this a goal that I want to set myself? And this is sort of the difference between these machines that pursue this or that simulate something like goal-directed behavior, and then the human being that can not just, you know, implement some sort of technique to achieve a goal, but also decide whether that goal is worth pursuing at all. We'll see more again about, you know, how this works over the course of this chapter, but that's sort of where we are in the big picture of the argument. Does someone want to pick up from the beginning of the chapter?
I can read. just quickly wanted to note what I put in the chat. It's just something that I have been thinking about in this, as we read this book, that, you know, as you mentioned in chapter one, Rouye points out these empirical gaps between, what we know human beings are capable of doing or living beings are capable of doing, and what we can build machines to be capable of doing. Uses this empirical gap to motivate this assertion of a difference in kind between, at least the human being and machines that are capable of bringing about some effect. But, obviously, as we've discussed, technology has changed a lot since Rouye wrote this book. And, you know, the empirical gap is still present, but not as obvious as it used to be. I guess what I'm thinking about is, what happens when, if the empirical gap were to be like completely closed, so that there would be nothing that you could point to that would differentiate human behavior from machinic behavior. Even if we found Rouye's arguments convincing about earlier stages of technology, perhaps could reasonably assume that the argument in principle would hold, then, you know, what could you point to, I guess, to motivate that distinction once the empirical gap is closed? It's not something like we have to, you know, like come up with an answer for now or anything, but it's just something that I have been thinking about.
Like you said, we don't answering this question is probably the task of the whole book, but we can, point to a couple, I can point out like maybe a couple of like elements of what his sort of line of argument is, I think, for this. Maybe it helps to like differentiate a few different like kinds of argument that he presents in this book, and maybe doesn't always like sort of set out as like distinctly as I would like to set them out. So one thing is looking at the claims that the cyberneticians are making for the specific technologies that they're describing, and then pointing out that like their sort of the morals that they're drawing from this technology are, you know, go beyond what the technology itself actually displays. So like, you know, you set up your little artificial tortoise that does these neat little things in your like artificial setting. And you say, oh, this is what like, you know, a real tortoise is actually like. It's just like a sort of more complicated form of this like simple artificial tortoise. And so Rie points out that, yeah, this is like a big extrapolation from that you've you know, set up this simple device that does some, you know, neat little things. It's kind of a party trick, really. It's not like you haven't really like grasped the sort of the essence of animal behavior just by setting up like three feedback circuits in a little, you know, robot car. So that's like one kind of argument, just like sort of pointing out the gap between the what is actually achieved by these devices and what the cyberneticians sort of draw from the existence of these devices. And then I think a second kind of argument is like I guess maybe a more in principle position that this gap is not just a sort of contingent accident of like the technology is not developed enough so far, but like in future we'll have like even better robot tortoises that are you know, capable of everything that a living tortoise is capable of. So of course this is you know, a promissory note at this point from the people developing these technologies. But Rie, I think, would argue that this is always, there's always going to be this gap. There never will be this like empirical coincidence of the capacity of the artificial device and the capacity of the living being. So of course we have artificial devices today that do a lot of things that I'm sure Rie would never have thought possible, you know, translating a text, for example, with like relatively good quality. You know, computer vision stuff, I'm sure, is much better than he would have ever expected. But of course, there still is that empirical gap. You know, even, you know, there's a lot of like hype around, you know, ChatGPT and all this stuff, but it's really not that sophisticated in a lot of things. It's essentially just putting together, you know, sort of a kind of like pastiche of different texts that it's found on the internet and, you know, assembling it into like a not very good, like undergrad essay is like sort of the peak of its performance at this point. There are like more, I guess, more interesting things like the AlphaFold that, you know, has like come up with a pretty interesting work on like protein folding stuff and, you know, things like that that are like more specific problems. But like in terms of general purpose, like sort of being able to solve problems, it, you know, these, even the sort of the most advanced AI things that are in existence now are still pretty far away from even like, you know, the average 10-year-old in terms of like solving a problem. So yeah, there's like the second step, I guess, is like moving from this empirical gap between the existing technology and some of the claims that are made around it, or like the lessons that are being drawn from it, to like an in principle gap, saying that there never will be a technology that that sort of closes that gap, like ultimately closes it and fully reproduces all the capacities that a living being has. And then I think the third step is like from this empirical, this you know, predicted continuation of an empirical gap, that like there never will be this complete reproduction of a living being's capacities by an artificial device, sort of drawing from that this like assertion of the sort of difference in kind between these types of performances, that like the sort of mechanical processes that go on in these machines, even the most sophisticated information machines, are fundamentally different than this sort of survol. I can never remember what the English word or the English translation of that term is, but like sort of overview of the situation, or what you know, we saw with Merleau-Ponty, he describes it as this melodic awareness of something, that like you grasp the melody as such, as this sort of intrinsically structured whole, rather than, you know, grasping one note and then the next note and like sort of learning the pattern of connection from one to the other. It's this like overview, oversight, or whatever the term is, that is sort of fundamentally different than what a machine can do. But maybe the sort of complicating factor for Rie compared to Merleau-Ponty is that Rie also takes that like the development of a living being and, you know, ultimately like matter as such is part of like he has this sort of panpsychist line of thought as well. So like a living being, you know, the embryo that develops into a chicken is also sort of following this melodic pattern or this survol. So it's not just a matter of like, you know, the soul and the body sort of being these two separate things that are connected to each other in some mysterious way, but you have instead this like development of a living being that is sort of guided by this overview or this melodic structure or something like that. And yeah, so it's the development of a living being is in some sense analogous to a human's goal-directed behavior as opposed to a machine's functioning. But yeah, he gets into this a little bit in the last chapter of the first edition of the book before he has the sort of follow-up chapter in the 1967 edition. So we'll get to that eventually. But yeah, so I think it's like a kind of step-by-step argument. Of course, each step is like more speculative than the others. Like he's making an empirical prediction in the second step. And then he's making like an ontological assertion in the third step. But each one is supposed to be sort of drawing the consequences from the previous one. And so like, if you find the first step convincing, then you should be like sympathetic at least to the second one and so on. So that's sort of how I understand the like stages of this argument. So it's not just a pure assertion, but it it does require like a certain like extrapolation from, you know, the fact that there is this empirical gap in the first place to like a prediction of you know, the impossibility of closing that gap to like that sort of statement of this difference in principle, difference in kind between these two realms at the third step.
Interesting. Thanks. Yeah. It does seem like he would be skeptical about, you know, the possibility of closing the empirical gap based on what we've read so far. So yeah, that makes sense.
Do I pick up from the beginning of the chapter?
Yeah. Chapter 2, framing activities and framed mechanisms. In the last chapter, we saw that all the internal difficulties of cybernetics stem from the same error of principle and the biased postulate that information machines are the complete equivalent of living and conscious nervous systems. This mechanistic postulate drives all the failures of cybernetics, the failure to understand the origin of information and the implicit acceptance of a true perpetual motion of the third kind, the failure to understand meaning, and the failure to understand the perception of universals or learning. We must therefore move on to a deeper and more general criticism, or more precisely, a positive reinterpretation of cybernetics free of its mechanistic assumptions. We must give up the claim to replace the conscious nervous system with machines and instead consider the machines as subordinate to the living nervous system and framed by them. First and foremost, we must acknowledge that the assembly in the active sense of the word of any mechanism is quite different to the assembly in the passive sense of the fully constituted and functioning mechanism. Active assembly is the work of consciousness, which creates connections according to a meaning. Passive assembly is the set of connections once they are restored, and automatic assembly can replace connections improvised by consciousness. What is the common element of all automatic assemblies? What does the constructor spontaneously look for when he wants to mechanically imitate conscious behavior? The answer lies in this word, connection, liaison. The manufacturer is always asking himself, quote, what kind of connection should be made to achieve the desired effect, unquote. For the calculating machine, this is obvious. The construction problem for the radio handyman who wants to make a quote unquote Simon, as well as for the professionals who want to build a new mark, it is a problem of connection. The manufacturer obtains hundreds of electronic tubes and hundreds of meters of wire and starts welding according to the assembly diagram. Colin and Burkhardt's machine existed in principle from the day Shannon realized that logical algebra was translatable into electrical circuits. For self-regulating automata, this is no less obvious. It should only be remembered that there may be connections of a different kind than sliding linkages, liaison par glissière, or electrical wires. An electrical or magnetic field or an ordinary dynamic constraint can be used as well as a kinematic connection. The function of the regulator, that of Watt, for example, depends on the establishment of a connection that is, on the one hand, kinematic. The regulator deforms and acts mechanically on the intake, and on the other hand, dynamic. The deformation is carried out by centrifugal force. But before the assembly was carried out, before the purchase of wires and welding equipment, the connections had to exist already in the constructor's consciousness. A machine with imperfect regulation must be guided by a supervisor whose consciousness, quote-unquote, closes, in some manner, the circuit of a semi-mechanical, semi-psychic feedback. The machine yet to be built exists as a semi-differentiated schema, the parts of which are linked by the general meaning of the effect to be obtained. Before this schema, an even more thematic premonition existed in inventive thinking. From the prescient consciousness to the schematizing and surveying consciousness, then to the supervising consciousness that completes the machine, we finally arrive, with full automation, at the total replacement of consciousness by a set of, quote, substituted connections, unquote. These reproduce by pushing or pulling, by conducting from one person to another, the primitive connections inherent in the, quote, absolute survey, unquote, that characterizes consciousness. Consciousness, or meaning, is not an ineffective atmosphere. It is, if we oppose metaphor to metaphor, a, quote, creative nebula, unquote, of which the automaton is only the residue. The feeling of, quote, unquote, and, quote, unquote, or is transformed, for example, into a pattern of, quote, two paths placed end to end, unquote, or, quote, two equivalent paths, unquote. This schema is in turn transformed into real electrical circuits. The feeling, quote, the machine is going too fast, the intake should be reduced, unquote, changes into, quote, the speed should control the intake, unquote, and then into, quote, automatic control schema, unquote, then into, quote, actual control by negative feedback, unquote. The metaphor of, quote, unquote, nebulous consciousness is still only a metaphor, but cybernetics itself suggests a more precise definition. Consciousness without auxiliary machines is a kind of putting in circuit of the elusive X center of individuality with the world of meanings and values. Consciousness implies a kind of axiological feedback, which is unrepresentable in its totality in the spatiotemporal world, through which transspatial meanings and values inform, by recurrence, the spatial part of the nervous circuits. Anticipating consciousness is in contact with an invisible and unobservable, but not supernatural, meaning or ideal that controls its processes of realization. The quote-unquote ideal, which can be materialized in the automatic machine, is obviously second to the non-materialized ideal of the conscious being. Similarly, quote-unquote substituted connections are second in relation to the connections improvised by consciousness, or the actual assembly in relation to the designated assembly. It's because I want to get warmer that I turn up the thermostat. Machine automation is a kind of spatial projection of something that is hyperspatial. Yeah, so this the beginning of this first paragraph seems to be saying what you were just saying about the, where does he say it exactly? The positive reinterpretation of cybernetics. So I guess that would be kind of the shift to the ontological account. Although maybe also Rouillet is saying that he's going to take some aspects from cybernetics and apply them differently to the relation between consciousness and the machine, differently from the mechanistic cybernetic understanding of feedback. And it seems like he's saying that the machine is the creation of a series of physical connections which realize some plan that the schematizing consciousness has in mind, and kind of just is the realization of that schema, and is completed by it as the kind of the means to the end of the realization in the mind of the engineer. And then this last paragraph is interestingly speculative. The idea that there's this an X center of individuality, which has like a axiological feedback loop with the world of like human culture, or meanings and values, which is kind of the maybe I guess the ultimate source of possibly meanings and values themselves, but also the, you know, instantiation of machines in a series of, complex physical connections.
Yeah, I think these, like, couple paragraphs here are, like, very sort of typical Fourier kind of thing, where he's like going from these like sort of analyses of these specific cybernetic machines or whatever, and then within a couple paragraphs he's gone into this creative nebula that is like outside of space and time and so on, that like this like sort of like flight from this like very specific problem to this like much more general sort of metaphysical problem. So yeah, of course there's varying degrees to which we might be sympathetic to that flight. I don't think even he would say that this is like a sort of like a rigorous argument or something that like should be decisive, and that like if you don't acknowledge the force of this position that you're being irrational or something like that. But I think he's like, so to sort of pick up on the point that you mentioned about like this sort of positive reinterpretation of cybernetics, of course, like if the point of the book was just to say that cybernetics is wrong, like that they've made mistakes about like the function of these machines or what we can learn from these machines, like that would not be that interesting, especially 60 whatever years, 70 years later, saying that people 70 years ago who were enthusiastic about these machines were wrong is like not that interesting. But I think what is more interesting is trying to like figure out what it is that they sort of got right, that like cyberneticians did actually grasp something that is important, that allows us to understand the functioning of living beings better and so on, that Fourier would have acknowledged that, of course. But then sort of picking up the like place where that kind of thinking breaks down, like where exactly does that sort of attempt to understand a living being as this like feedback mechanism or a collection of feedback mechanisms that are linked up in a certain way, where does that break down? And that's like the point that he wants to like home in on and sort of like, not allow the cyberneticians to sort of like gloss over that point. I think that's what he's trying to do. And that's like a much more interesting project that sort of has validity beyond the specific claims that the cyberneticians were making, that obviously no one is making in exactly the same way today, although there are a lot of similar types of claims that are being made about like, the AI things that we see, around the world today. But yeah, so he's sort of like, at the beginning of this chapter, just sort of like setting out this distinction that I was pointing to, this between like, the framed mechanism. So this is a system that is set up in such a way that its different components are linked in some sense, that like what component A does affects what component B does and limits what component B is capable of doing, right? Like a machine is only useful if that somehow, what a certain component, like the input buttons, for example, like if the what happens to those buttons limits what the machine is capable of doing. If you had a machine that was capable of doing anything, that like you could press buttons and then you'd never know exactly what would come out, this would not be a particularly useful machine. It would not really help you to achieve a goal. Like the whole point of a machine is to like set things up and organize things in such a way that you can reliably bring about some sort of effects that you want to bring about. And so you're sort of narrowing down the possible behaviors of the components by linking them to each other in this way. What he's sort of pointing out here, yeah, it's a realist effect machine. Yeah, you press buttons and then sometimes you get an umbrella next to, what is it? I forget the image there, like umbrella on a desk next to a lobster or a sewing machine. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, you never know exactly what will come out. You just sort of press buttons and then you get some sort of random results. So this machine, it'd be hard to say what exactly the purpose of such a machine would be, but even then you might say its purpose is to produce a surprising combination of objects. Maybe that's like a kind of a strange choice to make a machine that does that, but it's still doing something that you designed it to do, right? So a machine is just something that is set up in such a way that like the different possible events that can go on in this machine are limited by the connections between the different components or elements of this machine. And what he points out here is that like this machine as it exists, like once it's up and running, this is an entity that exists in space and time. It has like parts that are connected to each other. in such a way that the parts, are only capable of doing certain things and not other things, assuming the machine is functioning properly and doesn't break down. But that machine doesn't sort of set itself up. It doesn't sort of pull itself into existence by its own bootstraps, right? Like any machine that currently exists, it was built by a human or designed by a human and then, you know, put together by some sort of automated process that was itself designed by a human, et cetera. Like at some point there's a human who decided, I want to produce this type of thing for whatever reason, or maybe just for fun or to see if they could do it or whatever. But you can only sort of go back so far in the process of like automatic production, your sort of automated factory that, you know, builds widgets on its own or whatever. Eventually you, and after a pretty short number of steps, really, you end up with a human who had to make a decision and say, this is something I want to do, this is a goal that I want to pursue, and so on. And then you can sort of reverse direction. Once you reach that human pursuing a goal or trying to realize something, you can sort of reverse the direction and follow the, I guess you can call it like a descent from this goal, this ideal, or whatever that he describes here, that has this sort of non-spatial existence descending into realization into a spatial temporal machine that exists, you know, in a certain location at a certain time. So when he describes, for example, this Watt governor mechanism, so this is like he talks about this in the first chapter, but just to give a little recap, this was a device that was attached to a steam engine that regulates the speed at which the engine operates. So when the load on the engine is low, this governor, it has a little sort of centrifugal, it's essentially attached to an arm that spins around as the engine runs. And the faster the engine runs, the higher the arm will raise, which allows more steam to escape, which tends to slow down the engine, and vice versa. So as the engine increases in speed, the governor allows more steam to escape, which slows it down. So it's a negative feedback loop. And so this means that when you have a low load on the engine, the engine will speed up and more steam will escape, and then it will slow down again. But then when you have a heavy load on the engine, less steam escapes and it doesn't slow down, or it keeps the same speed. The sort of result of this mechanism is that the speed stays relatively constant. Whereas if you didn't have, so before this type of mechanism was introduced, you actually had a lot of times it was like little kids that were responsible for keeping the machine within like a safe operating range, so it didn't, you know, explode or whatever. So you'd have like a kid who would stand there and sort of watch the machine and sort of see, is it running too fast or too slow? You know, should I like increase or decrease the amount of steam being allowed into this machine? So here we have like, say, the designer of the machine or the factory owner or whatever has a goal, like the machine should stay within this speed range so that it doesn't explode. And at first, the sort of realizing that goal or maintaining that goal requires this conscious human being, this like, you know, 6-year-old boy or whatever, to stand there and actually watch it and keep it in that range. But then at some point, someone comes up with this governor that is capable of bringing about the same effect without any consciousness. So it doesn't require someone to actually be aware of, you know, is this machine running too fast or too slow? It's this like linkage that the different parts of the machine are now set up in such a way that in principle, it shouldn't be able to run too fast or too slow. It should always stay within the desired range. And so this is like a sort of exemplar of the process through which this this goal or this value or ideal, whatever, of, you know, keeping the machine in the desired range is sort of manifested into like a mechanism, into some sort of connection between the parts that ensures that this effect is brought about. And it's like a kind of substitution of this mechanical linkage for a conscious sort of operation of watching and you know, maintaining that speed within the desired range. And so this is like, I guess, sort of the, like, yeah, this exemplar or paradigm of what is happening. And this is also the case for like the development of a living being, that like for him, the embryo that turns into the chicken or the acorn that turns into an oak tree is basically the same kind of thing as the process of development that goes from the 6-year-old boy watching the machine and keeping it within the range to the formation of, or the invention of this governor that links the machine in such a way that it automatically keeps the same range. So like the egg, the embryo is like in some sense undifferentiated. It has just, the, you know, obviously it's not purely undifferentiated. There are like gradients of chemicals, et cetera, but it sort of comes to have differentiated structures. The adult chicken has, you know, probably hundreds of different cell types, you know, different types of tissues and organs and so on. And these, you know, different, these sort of structures are analogous to machines, that, you know, there are things like, you know, temperature regulation in a chicken, and, you know, regulation of different concentrations of chemicals in the blood and so on. These are sort of analogous to machines, but they are brought about by something that is not itself a machine. The egg is this, is something that sort of in which the machines or these living machines sort of are brought about, but you can't sort of explain the coming into existence of a machine by just appealing to another machine. You have to at some point to something that is not itself a machine. And I think also here, maybe like this is a bit of an aside, but I think we can sort of link this with like some of the discussion in like philosophy of biology about the notion of a function. This is like sort of like the, like there, I forget who it was. There's like a biologist who said something about how like teleology. So like, you know, the notion of a function is a sort of teleological concept. And someone said that teleology is sort of the mistress of biology, a very patriarchal metaphor, but like it's the idea that you, the teleology is something that the biologist can't live without, but doesn't want to be seen with in public. So like, there's a certain sense that, of course, that if you look at a bird, like a wing is obviously for flying, like that's the function of a wing, you know, except maybe in an ostrich or a penguin or whatever, but, or, you know, a heart is for pumping blood. Like, this is a clear, like any theory of biology or philosophy of biology that doesn't account for the fact that a heart is for pumping blood has like sort of missed an important point of like the nature of living beings. But at the same time, if you sort of ask the average biologist, you know, what do you understand by function? Like what is a function? Where does a, what kind of sort of ontological realm does a function exist in? They would probably give some sort of vague appeal to evolution as like, you know, when I talk about functions, what I really mean is that, you know, the organisms that had a heart or that, you know, had some sort of mechanism for pumping blood were more effective at reproducing and surviving to have offspring, to have offspring that reproduce, et cetera, than the other organisms or something along those lines. And there's, I mean, there's like a whole sort of subdiscipline of philosophy of biology about like whether that's an adequate explanation or not. There's, you know, reason to be skeptical about it, like sort of, you know, exhaust what we mean by a function of something. So this notion of function is like one of the key concepts of biology, but no one really has a convincing explanation for what exactly a function is, and then what relation there would be between the function of something and the, you know, actual sort of physical structure of whatever it is. You know, a heart obviously needs to have certain kinds of structure to be able to fulfill its function, but like what exactly, like how are those things related to each other, if assuming that we don't want to appeal to, you know, the creative design kind of argument or position that some intelligent being is like putting the biological machines together in such a way as to realize the function. So we have to have like a function is teleological, it's in some sense analogous to human goal-directed behavior, but at the same time, we have to be able to give an account for how this function comes to be fulfilled, or like how a machine that realizes the goal can be set up without having anything that is sort of aware of that goal or consciously directed towards that goal. And yeah, there doesn't seem to be a good account available of like what that would look like. It's like goal-directed behavior, but it's not an we don't have any sort of comparison case of something that is, you know, goal directed, but not conscious or not aware of the goal. So that's sort of like the general problem here. And this is even something that goes back to like Aristotle's criticism of Empedocles, for example. Like he talks about like you have these explanations for living beings in terms of the material components that like Empedocles sort of quasi-evolutionary theory was like there were all these different, you know, bits of living beings sort of floating around at random, like a, you know, some bone, some blood, etc., all just sort of floating around. And then some of them combine together to form like living beings that are sort of harmonious, that like all fit together in a way that allows for the being to survive. And then others came together and formed these like monstrosities that, you know, had 10 heads and no feet or whatever. And those ones didn't survive. And so that's why we find living beings that have this sort of coherent and harmonious structure, which is actually a pretty, you know, I think, clever kind of form of accounting for the nature of living beings, especially considering that this was written in like the 4th century BC. But Aristotle points out that like you can sort of like ascend the chain of causes, and you can say that like, you know, the bone has this structure because it's formed out of this stuff that came together in this way or whatever. But you are still you never get to the function just by looking at this sequence of mechanical causes or material causes. Like the fact that bones are, or one of the functions of bones is to support movement of animals that have bones, for example, that like, you know, the leg bones allow for this like lever function that allows the animal to move. This whole sort of functional side of things can never be explained just by pointing to what a bone is made of. Obviously, the material that bones are made of has to have certain properties. It has to be, you know, strong enough to support the weight of the animal and allow for the muscles to attach to it and so on. It has to have these qualities to be able to perform its function. But just pointing to the strength of the bone doesn't tell you anything about what the bone is for or why an animal has bones in the first place. And so this sort of disjunction between like the physical properties or these like mechanical linkages on the one hand, and then the functions on the other is like the same kind of disjunction that Ruyer is insisting on here. Okay, yeah, we can go on to the next bit. So I'll read the next page or so. Okay. This projection is always imperfect and incomplete. In many cases, it is even totally impossible. When my hand, monitored by my visual field, goes to take a full glass on the table, the ideal meaning of, quote, to take the glass without spilling it, unquote, is almost perfectly replaceable by a quote-unquote ideal for an automaton controlled by photoelectric cells and operating by means of stabilizing mechanism. The quote-unquote surveillance by the visual field is not really replaceable, but its effects are imitable. I think surveillance here is an ultimate translation for Sylvan. They might have translated it in different ways here. Anyway, but when the hand is that of an artist seeking a harmonious line, the invisible ideal, which nevertheless compels him to erase imperfect lines through a kind of negative feedback, cannot be replaced by any mechanical substitute. We can conceive of machines for making pointillist or cubist paintings starting from an automatic, quote-unquote, perception, and some artist brains seem to have worked as such a machine would work, but art would not be well served by it. How can we mechanically represent the regulation exercised on behavior by a demanding, quote-unquote, superego, and above all, by a purely spiritual ideal? Even in the case of the hand searching for the glass, there is much more in consciousness than in substituted automation. The visual field, with its multiple details, supervises and surveys itself in a unity that does not imply the existence of an external surveillance point. From such a field, by definition, all kinds of connections can be improvised and realized because they are already virtually present in its unitas multiplex. Moreover, the passage from consciousness to the machine is always possible. There is no more in the machine, but less. The machine is an extract. There is less in the automatic connection or in the materialized ideal than in the consciousness of the person who provided the connection in a flexible and improvised way according to an invisible ideal. The hand and the eye, the nervous conductors that guide them, and the observable parts of the cortex that control their operation by means of nervous feedback are themselves already auxiliary machines for the direct dynamic action of meaningful consciousness. The assembly of the mechanical automation is preceded by cerebral assemblies, themselves controlled by the binding action of the intention aiming at a hyperspatial meaning and informing the perceptual field or the behavioral field according to this meaning. If I am in a hurry, an essential value being at stake, first my psyche, then my nervous system are set up according to the theme, quote, maximum speed according to the circumstances, unquote. eventually an auxiliary machine such as a bicycle or automobile is put into operation to achieve this maximum speed. Consciousness envelops the brain assemblies as well as the auxiliary mechanical assemblies that complement or replace the brain assemblies, ready to correct both. Between the feedback of conscious connections and mechanical feedback, the brain is the domain of mixed feedback, the place where active assemblies are transformed into passive ones. It is a flexible and unfinished machine, easily and temporarily closed according to changing intentions. In relation to a machine whose automation is imperfect, the user's or worker's awareness plays the role of a pure auxiliary framed by the ensemble of the mechanism, and with improvised connections making up for what the assembly of the machine leaves poorly connected. At this level, the human being, quote, supplements without loss whatever human faculties the machine lacks, unquote. For example, if a red light appears on a car's dashboard indicating, quote, water too hot, unquote, I have to stop and remove the radiator cover that I had forgotten. An improvement would be the automatic adjustment of the radiator plug according to the temperature, eliminating the need for my conscious concern. We therefore understand the conviction of the cyberneticians. The improved automation perfectly replaces the conscious connections that remained inserted in the cycle of poorly adjusted mechanical connections. So they conclude, automation represents the entirety of conscious connections, but we also see their mistake. The quote-unquote inserted consciousness, far from representing consciousness in general, represents only an incidental and accidental role. The essential thing is the framing, enveloping consciousness that had to invent and combine all the mechanisms of the car as a means of transport. The isolated zones where consciousness needs to intervene, which remain in cases of imperfect mechanical operation, are destined to be eliminated. But this does not mean that the framing zones can also be eliminated. A well-automated device can be operated without conscious concern, but it must be built with even more conscious care. Just because lakes are a geographically transient phenomenon, this does not mean that the oceans are destined to disappear in the same way. Right, so this is, again, sort of insisting on this, on the difference between this, what he calls this inserted consciousness, so with like consciousness that sort of plugs the gaps within the functioning of a machine, on the one hand, and then the framing consciousness that sort of sets up the machine in the first place. So like the factory, the steam engine that, you know, you need to hire a child to monitor, here there's like a gap in the functioning of the machine, in that if you just leave it to its own operation, it will ultimately like overheat and explode, and then won't be able to function at all. And then you can improve the machine by sort of plugging this gap that previously had to be plugged by consciousness. You can add this mechanical linkage with the governor that prevents the machine from overheating and exploding. So this is like, and you can obviously keep doing this. You can keep replacing the human supervision of the machine by automated processes that prevent the negative effect from appearing in the first place. You can keep doing this more and more, having like more and more perfected automated machines. And, you know, eventually, I mean, to some extent, this exists today where you have these factories with like semiconductor production today, like designing chips building the chips that are using computers. Like, obviously, there's no way that a human being is going to be putting billions of circuits on a little chip, sort of by hand, or even supervising machine doing it. Like the machines are doing this in this automated way, there's still an involvement of humans in designing the chip in the first place, of setting up the machines in such a way that they will produce the chips according to the correct design, you know, testing the chips after they're produced, etc. Like there are still humans involved in the process at various other points. What Rie is insisting on here is that, like, this, you know, evolution of the automated process that sort of removes these gaps that have to be plugged by human beings, like that within the process doesn't really tell us anything about the possibility of ultimately eliminating consciousness from the process altogether. So the process might at some point sort of be executed without having human intervention as like a part of that process, as one of the links in the chain, or as filling a gap in the process, but there would still be the human decision to set up the process in the first place that can never be eliminated. And this actually, I think, ties in with something with something that Simon Don mentions in the introduction of on the mode of existence of technical objects, where he talks about automation, and he talks about how like this kind of fantasy of the automaton, of this machine that would, you know, function autonomously and wouldn't require human intervention, it kind of like leads to this idea of like a machine that would not just do what we want it to do, but it would want for us. It would like sort of replace the human desire with, you know, it would sort of stand in for the human that has a desire or a goal or something like that, which, you know, once you sort of set it out in those terms, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to think that, like, this would, something that Zizek would sort of make a, it's a not precisely the opposite kind of a joke about. But yeah, so this sort of fantasy of like replacing the human being altogether by a machine, kind of like once you sort of set out what that would mean, doesn't really make a lot of sense that like, yeah, you could potentially, in theory, that you could have this sort of process in which human beings don't have to intervene as like a link that, you know, prevents the process from running out of control, or that, you know, replaces a missing connection. Like you could fill in all those connections with some sort of sophisticated computer or whatever that keeps the whole thing running. But like someone had to choose to, you know, design this computer, to buy the parts that, you know, the computer is made from, to, you know, pay the electricity bill. All these things are like the result of someone deciding that, you know, bringing about the existence of this machine and all the materials and components and so on that need to be brought together to make the machine function. This was desirable. This was something that, you know, helps me to realize a goal that I have or something like that. So yeah, like that element is kind of ineliminable, at least I guess until we have machines that are capable of, you know, paying their own electricity bills and so on.
I wonder what Rouye would say about, like, it seems obvious that there are cases where, you know, one framing consciousness frames another framing consciousness. For instance, like, if somebody is, you know, wants to learn piano, the piano teacher, you know, has an idea, this kind of ideal schema for what they want the student to be able to do at the end of a series of piano lessons. And, you know, they do instantiate this, obviously along with the student, instantiate this ability in basically the body of the student to be able to, you know, play piano with whatever level of proficiency. So, you know, obviously one consciousness can frame another consciousness, but I guess unlike the case of the machine, which is framed by a human consciousness, the framed consciousness in the case of the two human beings, one of them could, you know, is framing in other respects, and like it's not exhausted by, it's not like you stop doing everything else in order to, you know, learn how to play piano. Although maybe there are like more extreme examples of learning, like they think about like in the Gateless Gate, like early stories, like Zen Buddhism, where people like really completely devote their lives to meditation under the guidance of a teacher. But yeah, it seems like the framed consciousness in that case could, you know, always decide not to, you know, merely instantiate the lessons of the framing consciousness, or, you know, maybe you could say that there, it's never an entirely like framed, you know, relation as it is between a human and a machine, so that it's more like a cooperation and co-framing of the abilities of the student. I don't know. I know he's not talking about this directly, but we've talked about something similar with respect to Simon Don and like the slave in revolt, for instance. So yeah, just kind of trying to think through what Rouye might say about that instance.
Yeah, I think the piano playing example was interesting because I was actually talking to a friend about something kind of similar as well, because so it's not just that you have the teacher that can sort of bring about the structuring of the or the inframing, I guess, of the students, you know, dispositions, but also the student has to sort of make themselves like frame their own behavior, if that makes sense. Like they have to sort of build themselves into a machine that is capable of playing piano. And a lot of, like, you know, when you are playing piano, a lot of what you're doing is actually quite mechanical, that you have to, you know, practice scales and arpeggios and so on that are not themselves, like, musically interesting, that you are doing this in such a way that your, you know, fingers and muscles and so on respond in this reliable way to, you know, bring about this musical performance. So, like, the melody, you know, the structure of this musical composition and everything is something that is not itself mechanical. But to be able to perform it, you have to, you know, turn your body into a reliable piano playing machine. You could have, like, you know, the most beautiful vision of your musical creation, but if you just, your fingers just are not good at hitting the right notes at the right time, then you won't be able to share that vision with anyone, and or even sort of realize it in the world, to sort of manifest it in the world as a thing that actually exists. So part of what you're doing, I guess, when, like, practicing, or the notion of practice, part of it is, like, sort of self-framing. I think it's a sense of, like, you are working to make your body and your, I guess, existence into this partly mechanical, this sort of machine to perform a certain effect in a reliable way. But you're always doing so, of course, in relation to a goal. Like, even if you're, you know, one of these kids whose parents, you know, makes them do piano lessons because they have some sort of like bourgeois ideal that, like, the, you know, this is what a well-behaved kid should do is, you know, learn to play the piano or something like that. In this case, you're sort of, you know, subordinate to what your parents decide for you. But it's still your parents have this vision or this ideal of, you know, what the well-behaved child should be. And they are, you know, through you realizing that vision. You know, I think there's a lot of reason to think that this is maybe not a great vision or a great, you know, choice that for the parents to make, but it's still, you know, some sort of, it's still setting up an ideal or a value to be realized, and bringing a machine into existence here, in this case, a machine that is made up of the, you know, muscles and nervous system of the child. It's still sort of implementing this mechanical linkage that, you know, will serve to produce the effect desired in a reliable way. And I think what Rivier would want to insist on is that any kind of action that we make, even if it's not something like the, you know, parents deciding to force the child to take piano lessons, but if it's I personally decide I want to learn how to play piano, this is like a project I set for myself, it still involves this kind of conversion from this, like, transspatial or hyper physical realm of ideals or values into some kind of mechanical linkage into a kind of machine. You know, if I want to play the piano, of course I have to practice, I have to, you know, turn my muscles and nervous system into a machine for playing piano. But if I want to I don't know, learn how to ride a bike, I have to do the same thing. I have to turn my, you know, muscles and nervous system into a bike riding machine that, you know, will be able to maintain my balance while I'm riding the bike, etc., you know, navigate around obstacles, all these things that you, all the sort of component skills that go into riding a bike. And even maybe, like, at a more abstract level, if I want to, like, write a novel, I mean, it helps, of course, to have, like, you know, the typing machine set up in your nervous system at the outset, or, you know, the writing with a pen machine set up in your nervous system. But those are maybe not entirely essential. You could, like, dictate a novel to someone if you wanted, but again, you still have to use the speaking machine. You have to have, you know, your tongue and vocal cords and jaw muscles, etc., linked up in such a way as to, you know, produce words that another person can understand. And, you know, machines have to be set up in the first place. But even something like, even if you sort of abstract from the, like, communication aspect of writing a novel, like, the whole just the sort of craft of, you know, writing dialogue that, you know, doesn't sound really stilted and awkward, you know, doing sort of descriptions and all the different sort of skills that go into, you know, that make one writer a good writer and another one a bad one, that is also involves practice. Like, anything you read about, like, how to learn how to write will just say that the main thing is just, like, writing a lot. You just have to keep practicing it. And if you, you know, don't do that, then you just will not become a good writer. And so, like, at a more abstract level, you are setting up these machines sort of within your invention faculty, your imagination, whatever you want to call it, your ability to create stories and characters and dialogue, et cetera, that people want to read. All of this has to also sort of produce these like more abstract machines that allow you to reliably, write dialogue that reflects the personality of the character who's speaking, for example. Like all these sort of skills have to be acquired and sort of set up as well. So like this survol, or this like role of consciousness, is not this sort of like abstract, like pure, like arbitrary decision-making capacity. In the last chapter, he like sort of contrasts what he's talking about with like Sartre's like account of consciousness as freedom. It's a kind of freedom that is always like realized in some kind of linkages, or it can only ever exhibit itself in some sort of transforming itself into a machine of some kind. So it's transformation of freedom into a machine, or of consciousness into a machine. That's what we actually see in the world, rather than this sort of pure freedom or pure consciousness that would not have any, that would be completely independent from any machine. One, I think, last bit that I'll mention in this passage is he talked about like how the visual field as like his, this is I think kind of his like paradigm case for this idea of the survol, or like this absolute survey or whatever. And so the idea here is that like when you talk about the visual field, there's like, I think, a certain temptation to like imagine the visual field as like a picture that some little man inside your head is looking at. This is like a sort of like recurring issue that comes up again and again in like physiology, psychology, et cetera. And so like there was this like discussion, I think, like in the early 20th century about like the fact that the image that is projected onto our retina is actually upside down relative to the world outside. Like if you sort of examine the inside of someone's eye while they're looking at something, the image that is projected onto the back of the eye where the retina is actually upside down. And so the question was like, how do we actually see the world right side up when the image is upside down? And sort of like the presupposition behind this question, of course, is that there's something in your eye or brain or wherever that is like looking at the image on your retina and then has to like, you know, somehow figure out how to reverse this image and put it right side up again. But then, of course, that just sort of pushes the problem back another step, because if there's a little man in your head looking at that image, then how does that little man see the, like, you know, he must have like an even smaller retina that is looking at the first retina, and then you haven't really explained the seeing process in the first place, right? The retina example and this sort of inverted image problem is like a sort of very sort of concrete and obvious instance of like sort of this homunculus problem, that like the idea that you explain some sort of cognitive performance within the brain by positing like something that is itself like at least as sophisticated in terms of like cognitive capacities as the performance that you're trying to explain, which ultimately doesn't really explain anything. But like the idea here is that like the visual field doesn't require something standing outside of it that would sort of look down on the visual field or look at the visual fields from outside and see the, you know, shapes and colors and whatever. Like the visual field, the visual field itself is a seeing. It is a grasping of the shapes and colors and so on that are present in that field. It's not something that has to be looked at from outside. And so it's this sort of like imminent grasping of structure, I guess, is like what he's sort of insisting on here with this notion of survol. In the same way that for Merleau-Ponty, like when we talk about a melody, you have to, you know, understand this melody as something that we can grasp as such, rather than as a sequence of notes that, you know, lead from one to the next. You don't sort of like stand outside the melody there's just sort of like picture one note and then, you know, have that sort of lead to the next, but you instead have to be able to grasp the melody as having this imminent structure or intrinsic structure, the same way that the visual field has to itself be a seeing as opposed to be something that would be seen.
That's a helpful way to understand what Rie is talking about with the idea of survol It's a bit harder for me to kind of get my head around how the same kind of thing could be going on. I know, he thinks that, it's not really even just the brain that's, this finality can't be, the origin of the finality can't be located in the brain because the embryo itself produces the brain. And there's this, kind of self-survey happening at the level of the embryo itself and even of like very simple life forms. And I think even like atoms and cells and molecules for Rouvier. I find it like maybe a bit easier to understand by analogy to the visual explanation, but still a bit obscure in those other cases.
Yeah, so like I think this is another instance of this kind of flight of speculation that I mentioned earlier, where like he takes like a quite a concrete example, like the fact that we can't sort of explain how, you know, the visual field is related to vision, or like what the connection between the two is, by, you know, postulating that the visual field would be seen by something outside the visual field. He takes that and sort of like extends it into this like general metaphysical principle of something like this imminent, like self-presentation or self-appearance or something like that, that like, you know, survol, this absolute survey, this something that would not need to be seen from outside to be able to be seen in here, seeing, of course, in the very abstract sense and not in a physical sense. This is, again, this sort of like speculative extension from one limited domain into like this general metaphysical principle. And of course, you know, how convincing you find that is, I think he would himself say that like this is not something that you have to accept. It's something that you can sort of evaluate the specific case and then find, you know, determine how far you want to go, you know, how far you want to follow him along that speculative flight. Okay, so we can keep going. Maybe we could just read one more passage and discuss and then stop there for the day, if that works for everyone.
Yeah, that sounds good. I will read the first page or so of this next subsection. So this subsection is the set. We will now examine the relations of the framing activity and the framed mechanisms more closely. Suppose that, and then there's an indented line, I, and then in brackets, seek to achieve, close brackets, an organic state of comfort. Outside the brackets is the framing part, the act of individuality on the one hand, so the I, its ideal on the other, which is an organic state of comfort. Within the brackets, which is seek to achieve, is the framed part, which can be more or less mechanized. The organic state of comfort is not a pure ideal in the sense that it does not have to be the object of a pure invention. I have already experienced it, so it is, quote, nemified, unquote, and it also depends on the current state of my organism. But whether pure or impure, it nevertheless has the essential character of the authentic ideal, sorry, my cat, of not being physically inscribable in a device. Now let's insert a device. Sitting in my office in the winter, I find the temperature a little low. In brackets, I go to my apartment's heating boiler, I raise the graded scale set on the thermostat from 50 to 60 degrees. The thermostat works, the temperature rises, close brackets, and I feel more comfortable. Another example. I'm going to the place of a friend who lives on the fifth floor. When I get to his house, I set myself, bracket, to climb the stairs, close bracket, to reach the required floor. If there is an elevator, I, bracket, press the fifth floor button, wait for the elevator to execute the quote-unquote order, close bracket, and enter my friend's home. An aviator, if he feels diverted from the initial course, or if the aircraft, quote-unquote, rolls, bracket, consults the artificial horizon or course indicator, then acts on the controls, close bracket, and brings his aircraft back on course. If the aircraft is equipped with an automatic piloting system, the pilot does not even have to feel the deviation. Gyroscopes with vertical and horizontal axes control the maneuvers necessary to correct the deviations themselves by means of pneumatic servo motors. The aviator only intervenes if the automata do not work, just as I take the stairs if the elevator breaks down, or I exercise to warm up if the heater does not work. See table 2.1. We could indefinitely multiply the examples, drawing them from either an effort of memory using auxiliary mnemonic means, or from an effort of imitation, economy, expression, and so on. We see that in phase two, we can have either the activation of a fully assembled effective machine or the assembly of what psychologists call a quote-unquote set. It has become established practice to use the English word quote-unquote set to refer to any psychophysiological setup, any neuromuscular adjustment that favors an action, either by preparing it, for example, quote, taking the physical and mental attitude for starting a race, unquote, or by favoring it through control while the operation is in progress. For example, quote, sacrificing everything for maximum speed during the race, unquote. The set acts as a selective factor, facilitating some responses and inhibiting others. The set is the putting into relation of the neuropsychological apparatus and a meaning or value beyond raw sensation. Without the set, the sensation would remain in the state of ineffective impression and would even cease to be a conscious sensation. While driving a car, I cannot, without danger, be in the state of an impressionist painter. I watch out for vehicles coming out of the side streets and any shadows that appear, given value in advance by the psychological assembly. Quote, beware of vehicles crossing my path, unquote, very quickly triggers the appropriate movements. Similarly, quote, drive on the right, unquote, is valued in relation to, quote, drive on the left, unquote. What is performed by the material assembly of a device is always a valuation of this kind. A thermometer in a room which does not control any temperature setting is therefore the equivalent of the quote-unquote impressionist state. If it is inserted into a thermostat to regulate a heater, the indicated temperature is efficiently given value. It becomes the optimum temperature, whereas the assembly of a machine is only given value by human intention. This intention, commanding the corresponding psychological set, must obviously be in direct relation with a meaning or value. The cerebral cortex, the place of the primary manifestations of the psychological sets, is related to two worlds, the world of meanings and values, the apperception of which is a constituent part of the set, and the world of our space, where it achieves the effect according to the set. So yeah, it's interesting that he seems to be perfectly fine with ceding to the mechanistic cybernetic account. The idea that we have these, that our body is basically composed of machines, very complicated machines, but, machines nonetheless. But these machines themselves are subordinated to finality in one way or another, including like in just the kind of untrained functioning of our organs, but also in terms of the kind of establishment of a disposition, to act in some way. Yes, this kind of is interesting dualism, this idea that the brain is sort of in two worlds, one of which is a world of values and one of which is the mechanical world of mechanistic organs and dispositions which can be established in the body.
Yeah, so it's always, like, even the word set has this kind of dual character, right? Like, he earlier talked about assembly having, like, an active and a passive sense. So you have, like, set in the sense of setting, like, the action of setting, like, you set yourself to respond in a certain way. You sort of, I don't know, if you're playing tennis, you sort of set yourself to hit the ball as it, you know, comes towards you. And then there's the set as the result of that action, like the disposition to respond in a certain way. And you always have to sort of, like, there's a dual nature of human and living beings, sort of capacities and behaviors. It always involves, like, the machine that is already existing, the set in the passive sense, and then also the bringing into existence of that machine, you know, setting yourself to respond in a certain way. So it's not that one is like, in a sense, the active sense is primary, and that it is only through the action that the set in the passive sense can come into existence. But at the same time, the set as action or setting as action can only ever sort of realize itself by becoming a set in the passive sense. So it can't, if you had like this pure action that didn't sort of turn into the passive sense, that would sort of not, yeah, that would be just kind of like an empty action. It would not actually produce any effect in the world. It would not manifest itself. So we can only understand action insofar as it realizes itself into this passive, essentially a machine.
I wonder if we, in these examples, the end state seems to be something that the subject is like representing to themselves in order to be able to bring it about by, like physical or mechanical means. But I wonder if this is representability of the goal is something that Rouillet thinks is necessary for his account of framing, or if it also contemplates like non-represented or non-representable goals. I'm kind of thinking of like the argument about Kant and practical reason, and whether or not practical reason is subordinated to like a knowledge condition, which would, on according to some criticisms, pose a problem for the freedom of practical reason from mechanistic determination for Kant.
Yeah, I think like in the case of the like embryology or development, developmental biology stuff, like he doesn't, of course, think that the egg is like picturing the chicken that it's going to develop into, or the acorn is picturing the oak tree that it's going to develop into. But we as outside observers can, of course, look at the acorn and picture the oak tree and, watch it requires things like, time-lapse photography and so on, but we can watch the development of the acorn into an oak tree from the outside, and we can sort of look at the way that it is, how it follows the patterns required to bring about the development into an adult oak tree. I guess there's a question of like, is the fact that the acorn doesn't represent the oak tree that it will eventually turn into, is that just a sort of contingent sort of empirical lack of a capacity on the part of the acorn? Or can we take it that there is something intrinsically non-representable, or is it possible that there can be a kind of directedness towards something that is not representable in principle, not just as a contingent fact about the being that is being directed? The case that the acorn doesn't have the capacity to represent the oak tree is just a contingent lack of a capacity on the part of the acorn. But is there something that, say, a human being could be directed by in such a way that what it's being directed by is not representable in principle? I'm not sure if he needs to have an answer to that question. My first inclination is to say that that's kind of independent of his theory, that either answer is probably workable for him, but you have to think about that more. So that point, Angus has put in the chat here about like this notion of like a possibility that was not possible until it was sort of realized. So this is something he's going to discuss more in the last chapter. Like, how do we make sense of the process of invention or creation? That like, it seems like you're stuck with a choice between either saying that these possibilities sort of pre-existed the action of invention or creation, that they were just sort of floating around in like a Platonic heaven. And that leads to like his example that he gives is like the sort of Platonic form of a bicycle was just sort of floating around, in 600 BC or whatever, that like, hundreds of years before anyone could even have conceived of a bicycle or like the components that make up a bicycle and so on. And that obviously is pretty implausible. And then on the other hand, it seems like the only other option would be to say that there's like this sort of pure emergence of something out of nothing that like would not sort of, you would not be able to give like a rational account of how someone could invent a bicycle, which also seems pretty implausible, because of course we know that bicycles were invented in a particular context of what kinds of technology was available, what kinds of problems people were facing that like they wanted to be able to get around and be able to transport themselves in this convenient way, etc. Like bicycles don't appear out of nowhere. We need some way to make sense of this like notion of invention that is neither this like appearance out of nothing or nor just a sort of transposition from the realm of the possible, which would just be the sort of ghost copy of the realm of the real, which, you know, Bakhtin criticizes as well. This kind of like alternate way of grasping what an invention is, I think is what he's sort of like trying to point us towards. I'm not too sure at this point like how successful he is at, you know, sketching that alternative, but some way of grasping that like an invention that is not either just a copying from the possible to the real, nor a creation out of nothing. But yeah, that's sort of getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, so we'll get there eventually. We'll stop here for today and continue with this chapter next time. Thanks everyone for coming out, and thanks for your contributions, and hope to see you next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Nan. See you next week. Hopefully we get some more people to join.